All right. Hey, y'all. It is grab your wallet time. We've been having fun doing this show. We love you guys for supporting us. Those of you that don't support us, patreon.com is where you go give us the money to get us to these people or beers to these people so we can interview them. And John's got some t-shirts. So that's on stealthisbeer.com/merch. Check that out. Either way, thanks for playing along. Can't believe we get away with this every week, Monday at 5.
Steal This Beer, a candid weekly discussion about beer, over beer, by a couple of guys that think about beer way too much.
All right, hey y'all, it's 5 o'clock on Monday. We're stealing beer. I am Augie Carton.
Oh, hi, Augie Carton. I'm John Hall.
Hey, John Hall.
I'm Justin Kennedy.
Cass, you don't sound anything like Justin Kennedy. Where is Kennedy today?
Upstate New York.
He's traversing hamlets and
he's finally putting the finishing touches on the upstate New York farm beer cookbook.
Yeah, he's writing the afterwards now, the epilogue. Yeah.
And scratch and sniff tag along partner.
Well, yeah, he goes around with rolls of tape and scientific vials, and he captures the aromas and puts them in the vials, and yeah, it's going to be a very, very exciting book.
I've heard his book is selling a ton these days.
That's what Dan Suarez smells like. Yeah.
I've heard his Boxing Day book is making tons of money as a COVID test. Like you scratch and smell it, and if it smells like book, then you've got COVID.
Yeah. That's about accurate. Hey, speaking of books.
Speaking of books, look, you see what I did there?
Yeah.
Like our accomplished wow, my tongue is in the way, is Jeremy Bannis, who among other things writes for a living. How you doing,
well,
Jeremy?
Thank thanks you for joining for us. Having me on.
Right on. So like Kennedy, who couldn't make it today because he's too important, and John Hall, who is not that important, you've written for a million things, including. I think, did you guys cross John? Because I know Beer Advocate's on the list, and I know I've read him a couple other places. Have you guys worked together writing? Has John ever edited you, Jeremy?
I did a small piece for John with craft beer and brewing.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've also known each other for years, and
yeah.
Sitting around that beer writer's bullpen, just throwing jabs.
Exactly. Oh. Yeah. Just, you know, talking shit about who got the most recent book deal. And it's usually Justin, and throwing some shade and knocking back pints. And well, yeah,
as we established in the cold open, Justin's book has two purposes these days. So, you know, that's what you got to build in your book, a little resiliency for pandemics. Anyway,
yeah, all of mine are just going to start coming with machetes now, just to like get through the wasteland that is going to be this country in a couple of years. That's great.
That's great. So Jeremy, Justin sent me a text a day last week asking if I'd gotten your book, and I still haven't. But the book I should have gotten that he was asking about, and I think that led him to bring you to us, is about Celis and Hoegaarden and craft. Yes, is that true?
That is true.
It's called Celis Beer, born in Belgium, brewed in Texas. And I have my copy of it right in front of me right now.
Of course, because you've got
you
a direct
hear the pages. They're just
they're crisp. But you have a pneumatic tube to every publisher that would ever write a beer book, whereas I just live alone in the woods.
Yes.
So we should point out that we're not saying Celis, S-E-L-L space U-S beer. We are saying the name of the gentleman responsible for all of modern brewing, Celis, capital C-E-L-I-S. So nobody gets confused by John and my Jersey accent on saying Celis.
You're saying all of modern brewing.
So here's the fun of
that. That is lofty.
Here's the fun of this. I don't know if Jeremy's up to do some battle and tease these points out, but I like everything. I could make the case that Celis begat what is American craft right now in all its good and its bad. I could also make the case that it was the marketing of what Celis did that. And I could make the case that the most fun one to do is I can definitely draw some direct lines from most of the decisions, at least for Hoegaarden, that leads to what is today's haze craze. And when you get somebody that hates hazy beer, they will always love the idea of Hoegaarden and defend it until you force them to acquiesce that one leads to the other. So I can go any way with this conversation. But I think first what we should ask
Jeremy should just choose his own adventure at this
that's
point.
That's what I'm saying. Jeremy should,
kids.
But first he should give the rowdown better than I will of who Peter Celis is in his kind
Pierre.
Of... Pierre. Sorry. I'm an American. But you know, just who he is and his path from postman to icon so that people know at least the foundation of what I will tear apart when it pisses John off.
Well, that East Coast pronunciation of his name is actually something that he would joke about. He'd actually was fond of saying that it was easier to just tell people it was spelled Celis versus Celis because it sounded like Celis and it was pronounced Celis to most people instead of them saying Celis.
Yep. We just did it.
Yep. So you did it anyways. but no, he, yeah, the man, the myth, the legend, so to speak. You know, you talk about the kind of responsible for modern craft brewing in general. And that actually is quite a lofty statement, although I think there could be a hell of a lot of support for it. And one quote that I had put in the book that I got from Garrett Oliver, Mr. Brooklyn Brewery and Crown Prince of Hats himself, had said to me once when talking about Pierre, you know, John's the Crown Prince of bow ties, Garrett's got the hats down. But I know Garrett had said to me when I was talking to him about it, is he said a couple of things about Pierre. He said, if Pierre was not in your pantheon of brewing gods, there's something wrong with you. And he said, it's very difficult to point to one particular person as the proponent of any one thing most of the time. With Whitbeer, you can point specifically to Pierre Celis in that he didn't invent Whitbeer, but he essentially reinvented it when he brought it back, reinvented it for everybody who brews it now. So that in and of itself is a heck of a lofty legacy. And I think Garrett right there is essentially going along with what you're saying in that he's in many ways kind of responsible for the way we approach brewing in the last 30 plus years.
Yeah, so absolutely. And so I guess what I'm saying, what I would like to make the case that he is the attention he paid to a certain part of brewing and its success amongst my generation of drinker leads us to a type of
Are you doing a telethon right now?
You got a problem with that? leads to a type of liberal thinking in approaching recipe development that I think had been successfully neutered by American brewing and German-driven brewing at the time, right? So just a couple choices. Wheat for its body nature, phenolics of ale yeast fermentation, and addition of complementary flavors to those phenolics. And much like you said, Garrett said, those things didn't not exist, but they weren't presented as here's a different way to make a super enjoyable beverage with very different flavors than adjunct lager. And it does all the things you're told brewers would never do while having a thousands of year old tradition, right? You can use wheat or other adjuncts for body and palate feel. You can add a couple spices to take it places. And you choose a yeast that complements the flavors you're going for. Now, all of that is the shenanigans that people bemoan about what's going on in craft right now, right? We're adding things we think make it taste better. We're adding high protein fermentables to change the body. And we're using these different ale yeasts that kick off fruity characters. So do you see the line I'm drawing from that becoming part of our... Okay, so that's what I said. If you want me to make the case, he and his work... And here's the problem, and what I'd like to learn from you largely while we talk about this is Celis as he exists in Texas, because I don't know that story. What I know is Hoegaarden and the orange wedge on the side of the glass and the marketing of that and how all these little steps that came to make it okay to do those things. And what I'd like to learn about is Celis.
Wait, you know was Hoegaarden the one with an orange slice, or is that Blue Moon?
Blue Moon takes it from Hoegaarden. The orange being in... so. There is orange peel, you know, Curacao orange or whatever it is in Hoegaarden. That existence is what Blue Moon markets when they add the orange. That's the tradition they're stealing.
How do you pronounce that beer that Augie keeps saying, Jeremy?
Hoegaarden?
Hoegaarden. Yeah. Well, technically speaking, it's Hoegaarden. You kind of accentuate the two A's at the end of it, but even I just say Hoegaarden.
Complete diversion here.
Yeah.
Complete diversion here. Do you guys watch Letterkenny?
No, I haven't seen it.
Periodically. All right.
Okay, because the way you hit the R in Garden is the is such a Letterkenny pronunciation. I really need to. Whatever happens when we're done with the show, I need to remember that. Anyway, go on.
I would just say Pierre in with Austin, that just to give a smidge of background without going into too much detail, after all the books available for $21.99 plus tax, and you can read the whole story.
Wow. Right on. Look well done.
That didn't even feel shoehorned.
I've watched Hall try to do that for 6 years and never nail it so succinctly. That was a perfect 10. You stuck the landing. No splash.
There you go. Thank you. but no, Pierre had left his relationship with the brewery that he founded, with the thing that had brought him to be very well known, not just throughout Belgium, but throughout Europe and really reasonably with a large part of the United States, with the Hoegaarden wit being exported outside of Belgium. You know, left that in 1990 after a very tenuous relationship with what was just InBev at that time. He had
before
AB. He had had a fire in 86 at the brewery. He was actually visiting him and his wife Juliet were visiting Atlanta, Georgia at the time. Fire broke out at the brewery. He rushed back, and at least 30% or more of the brewery, including the packaging hall, were severely damaged. They had to shift production to another brewery for about a year while they were built. But he found himself vastly underinsured, needed a whole lot more money to rebuild, and went to Stella Artois. At that point in time, Stella was still its standalone brewery that had opened a few others in Belgium, based in Leuven. And they were approached by Pierre, who had some contacts there. Leuven is not too far from Hoegaarden. He gets a little bit of seed money, the rest of the seed money he needs, but shortly after, Interbrew buys Stella and it forms InBev. InBev puts in, you know, they have, gosh, I think just over 50% ownership of the brewery with what they invested in there for him to use to rebuild. And essentially made things miserable enough for him that he eventually sells his shares and decides to try something else. Fast forwarding to Austin, Texas. He had connections in Austin, Texas already from having the beer exported. He had had Hoegaarden exported first into Texas, and into Austin, Texas specifically was the first place Hoegaarden beer was ever seen in the United States. And it was a little import company called Mannequin Brussels.
What was out of all of the markets that you could go into, Texas always struck me as a little bit odd, as like the first one to try to make a splash.
To round out John's question, when you said fast forward to Austin, Texas, I was like, wait a second, that's a big fast forward. Like, There's got to be more steps there. Is it there?
Well, sure, but he wants you to buy the book for $21.95 plus tax, enough, which is available online.
Fair enough.
Exactly. Yeah. there is a few more steps. I mean, he had he had contacts here already with as far as opening the brewery in Austin. He had contacts here already. Little import company started by two Texans that lived in Austin, formed a company called Mannequin Brussels, and helped import. One of the gentlemen, Jim Houchins, who was one of the founders of Mannequin, went to school in Leuven for a number of years and lived in Belgium, loved Belgium. And when he came back, partnered with another guy who was getting into the beer industry, Bob Leggett. And they decided to try to import in Belgian beers and other European beers. So they helped him bring in Chimay, a couple of others in Hoogarden. And actually in the book, I have a picture of the original agreement between Mannequin Brussels and Pierre to bring Hoogarden in. So this is prior to the fire. This is like 83, 84 when this is going on. So he's already making some contacts early on without even knowing it. A childhood friend of his had eventually moved to Austin. So he had already had a whole lot of contact with Austin, with Texas because of Hoogarden. And when he's looking at trying to do something new, he had always looked to the United States as what the future of his brewery was going to be anyway. So now that he's kind of starting over, he's looking first to Texas, and he actually had considered Florida for a while, because of Miami and Miami Beach and the lifestyle there. He soon decided, he says, to forego Florida because he said it's essentially full of people my age that go to bed early. And he said people tend to drink beer later at night. He's like, why am I opening a brewery down there? Little did he know now, right, with all the breweries in Florida.
If only he'd thought of pastry stouts instead of hazies. He could have had a deep Miami base. I'm going to diverge us for 1 second to talk about the glass, because that's my only job in this show. But then we'll get right back to this. And all right, so I forgot the question I was going to ask. So let me just get to glass one. So what brings us together on Steel and Spear is a candid conversation of beer, what it is, not what we thought it would be, how we like it, not how we were told we would like it. And what it's doing. To facilitate this, we drink blind out of opaque glasses. In the COVID situation, Justin goes to the world's coolest bodega, buys us beers, sends them around. This is the point where I make sure Jeremy has it. Jeremy, do you have a foil-wrapped, masking-taped 16-ounce can in front of you?
I do. It very much looks like the beers I would sneak back into the house and tell my mother it was.
Oh. Well, there you go. And this was last week, so that's
that was last week.
I have to say, Justin actually he either has an intern now who's really trying hard to impress, or in his newfound older age, because he just celebrated a birthday, he's actually stepped up his game, because these are really well wrapped and the masking tape is in the right spot. And mine actually came with proper bubble wrap, not leftover detritus from around his house. So
I really think Hillary's efforts step things up quite a bit at some point. But you have a different experience than I do, because I'm looking at a 16-ounce can one and a 12-ounce can two.
Yeah.
And can two looks like he worked to smooth it to like a glassy shine. Uh-huh. And can one looks like, well, looks like he was like, oh shit, I forgot to wrap can one, and just grabbed whatever his taco was wrapped in last night.
What I will say is my can two, he pulled off enough foil for a 16-ounce can, but wrapped the 12-ounce in it. So it's bunched at the bottom like there's a tumor or a bulge or something that is worrisome about this particular beer. So
it is not a tumor.
It's not a tumor. I was going to see who took that low-hanging fruit.
Well, Lauren's dad's best friend wrote that line, so I'm safe to use it around the house any chance I get. All right, so besides Justin's natty packaging, so I love this beer. This beer does a thing. So So, Jeremy, you haven't gone through, I think, almost 12 months, 11 months of Justin shipping you beer. But he kind of always leads with a Pilsner, which has been a fun case study in my own Pilsner experience, because I'm learning a lot of nuance into a style that should have a ton of nuance. But basically,
yeah, I feel like he just walks into the bodega and he's like, Pilsner, strong right. beer, IPA, stout.
Strong beer.
Pilsner, yep. strong beer, IPA, IPA stout. Stout. Yeah.
So if this is a milk stout, then he's done it so many times he's fooled me. But what I love about this one, and again, so you know, if you're making a case for Pilsners, you make a case for subtlety and small differences. And I've now been for 52 Saturdays in a row coming in thirsty and hungry to a Pilsner. And this one does that balancing act of a great Pilsner where there is a malty sweetness that is immediately stuffed down by a dried out yeast fermentation and a little bit of hop. And it's none of them are too far ahead of each other. All three play closely together. And this is, I wish I had done often, Jeremy. I've just come off a bike ride for these things. If I had just ridden a bike, this thing would be like the best. I'm tired, I'm thirsty beer I think I've had in a long time. I like this beer a lot.
You've already crushed it.
Yeah. The interesting thing about this one, though, if it's American, the brewer is showing tremendous restraint. Because it is European in every sense of what I envision like a great European lager to be, and so oftentimes like the American lagers will just have just that extra touch of hops to it where they're really sort of trying to assert themselves with the red, white, and blue, and this doesn't have that. So it's either an import or it's you know somebody who has really tried hard to stay like true to style.
Well, so all right, I know what you're saying, but I want to clarify here because there is a decided fresh hop character to it. Well, but it's all hot side hopping.
Well, let me ask you this though, because when I first poured this into the glass, when I first started drinking it, I got this very lovely fleeting whiff of like orange blossom or orange peel, yep. or some sort of like nice citrusy character. And now that I'm about halfway through this can, for the life of me, I can't find that again. So it was there just at the beginning, but it's now gone for, I don't know if anybody else.
I think what you're talking about is middle few, and that's what I'm saying. But I think.
A noble hop.
I think it's all hot side. And I think, you know what I mean? Because I've definitely got a decided hop presence, but not cold side aromatic edition, just cooked in nicely hot side editions. But yeah, there's a sweetness to it, but it's definitely a dry finish. Jeremy, why don't you tell us what you think?
No, I'm getting definitely to me like kind of a lot of a sweet and bready all at the same time at the beginning. And although the hop is a little suppressed, I agree with John. Either it's an American brewer that is showing a whole lot of love and skill for European pilsners
and
lagers,
skill.
Or a whole lot of love. Those are the most difficult beers almost out of a Saison to brew. But I'm getting the characteristic of this one actually reminds me of, has anyone had a Gaber pilsner?
Yeah, so,
oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of reminding me of a Gaber.
Yeah, I get that. So the one I wanted to ask about is what's that 8-bit, that 8-bit label one I was so in love with when we were having it live?
Oh,
it showed up very often.
Yeah.
Tall Grass Brewing, I think.
No. Tall Grass does 8-bit pale ale. This is that that German import. The begins with a T. It'll come to me at some point.
Anyway, it reminds me a tremendous amount of that beer, but that beer is far drier than this beer.
Okay.
So at first I was like, did they start canning that 8-bit thing? But then the sweetness makes me think it's not that, or the bottle was somehow tainting that. If it is, if they are canning it, then I But it's a little sweeter than I know that beer to be in my experience. Anyway, we don't need to get, I want to get back to Celis and Texas and all that. So
what is it, Cass?
It is a Krombacher Pilsner. So German imported beer, abundance of fruity hop aromas, which give way to the beautiful balanced malt backbone, fresh and smooth. The famous Fels, Squelwasser, and Hallertau hops ensure the beer is crisp, clean, and offers a refreshing, long-lasting, light, bitter.
Back to you, Augie.
Back to you. There you go. Wow.
That was like a thank you, Johnny Gilbert, right there. Like, my God.
Right, Brian in the field.
I'm producing.
That's right.
You are producing.
So, you know what?
You can this, Cass?
Yeah.
All right, so.
It's Cass International.
That would be amazing. So anyway, when we were talking about, so I guess the next question I want to ask, and I know you're kind of mid-Celis coming to Austin, but a thing that interests me here, especially because, and I'm still kind of confused on when in this story arc he lands in Austin and InBev becomes AB InBev. But my question is, was he kind of that typical European stalwart that when he did start doing his own thing, was he doing what an IP lawyer could claim was Hoegaarden again, you know what I mean? Or was he fooling around with new stuff? And was there any conflict when a guy who had been the guy behind what was one of their best brands at the time shows up in America making beer again? Like, is there, will the book reveal that besides the, you know, the picture that's already worth $21 with a $21.95 price tag? Hello?
Jeremy.
Oh
my gosh.
He got something happened. He got booted. I'm letting
him back. Oh, he's back in. He's coming back in.
I apologize, gentlemen. Not sure what happened.
No, that's
no
cool.
Worries.
Augie was talking, so we're going to get 7 minutes back of his question. Here we go.
you are the worker. Did you hear any of the question before I restart, or were you gone?
I heard the very beginning of it, right about the first 30 seconds of it.
So basically what I was saying is, as he leaves and comes here, InBev becomes a thing and then becomes AB InBev, and he's here and starting his own little brewery in Texas. And what I know of classic European brewers is he believes there is a beer, or in my prejudice for that type of person, when he starts brewing again, he's going to make, you know, the beer he's always made. And I imagine there's IP issues there. And I'm wondering if there's a part of the story where they're like, wait, you can't just open up in Texas, make Hoegaarden, and pretend that that's an okay thing.
Yeah, so he did not have any kind of waiting period before he could open up a brewery or anything like that. And he very much said, this is my beer. I'm going to brew it. There's a semi-famous story of him going so far as to smuggle his yeast strain in his socks in the United States to get it propagated. Obviously, this is way pre 9/11, but he's sneaking it through. Pierre is very much a ask for forgiveness, not permission kind of guy, even with his wife. For as nice as this guy's reputation is, he was definitely a, I've got my way, this is how it's going to be done, because there's a reason it needs to be done.
What is terrifying for me right now is the brewers who are listening to this, who are now going to start harvesting yeast swabs out of their socks.
Yeah, that's
and the
that's
flood of beers that are about to come with that.
I don't think he was dipping his socks.
But I'm saying this modern generation of Skittle Brow makers are definitely now taking their hiking socks and double dry hopping them. So that's all I'm saying. I'm saying it's a good idea.
Another rogue beer?
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
It's super rogue. Yeah.
But no, he gets here and he opens it up, and he can't use the Hoegaarden name, and he wasn't intending to anyway. But one thing that he was able to do was he When he first opened the brewery in 66, before it moved to the building that it's still technically in now in Hoo Garden, it was at his farmhouse brewery. And as both of you probably know, a large portion of the breweries in Belgium were really farmhouse breweries. When I was in Belgium, almost any place I went to, it's like if it's an old house, 200-year-old house, and there's a smokestack, chances are it brewed beer at some point in time. So he brewed beer out of his farmhouse brewery, and it was known as Brouwerij Celles, so the Celles Brewery. It's 10 years later when he moved to the location where it's at now, a former lemonade factory, that he changed the name to Duclos Brewery. But because of that, when InBev took over, there was no taking over the rights to the name Celles Brewery or Celles. So he moves to Austin and he's able to call it the Celles Brewery, and he brews Celles White, which was 98% the Hoo Garden wit. He just tweaked a couple of things.
Yeah. Well, the water source was different.
Similar enough to Belgium, though. That's one thing he talks about, is the water was similar enough to Belgium. I mean, yes, he did have to tweak the water profile for sure, but it was similar.
Makes sense. That's cool. So at least under his tenure, did Celles Brewing only make Celles White?
Go ahead.
That wasn't me.
No, I was just going to say John's AOL CD has finally loaded. But anyway, go on, Jeremy. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That might be the Amazon delivery I was expecting today. But he brewed quite a bit. So in addition to the Hoo Garden wit, in Hoo Garden, he brewed the Hoo Garden Grand Cru. He brewed quite a number of other beers. He brewed a quad. He brewed a couple of fruit beers. He brewed a raspberry fruit beer there as well. So when he comes here, first beer out of the gate, of course, is his signature wit beer. But the very second beer, just like in Hoo Garden, was his Grand Cru, his Belgian triple. So of course, here being brewed here, he had to call it a Belgian style, but it was identical to what he brewed in Hoo Garden as close as it could be. Of course, with tweaking, he brewed his Celles Raspberry, and those were essentially the three he brought back over from Hoo Garden. He added several more beers after that. He actually added what was referred to then as a golden pils, and now Celles still brews it and is referred to as a gold. They call it a golden lager, but he did brought the Celles Raspberry back. He added a amber ale that he called Celles Pale Bock to compete with Shiner Bock.
Yeah,
just like Shiner Bock, which is not truly a Bock.
No,
his wasn't either. But he put the Bock in the name to compete with Shiner. So they added a few other beers over the years as well, but they brewed a lot more than just the wit.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's almost by necessity. I mean, it's the style that everybody thinks of with him, but there are very few breweries that make just one style of beer and stick with it. I mean, Trumer is, I think, the only one that comes to mind in the US, but yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So would you rather next talk about his imprint on Austin and all the guys there now that we know and love, or would you rather talk about where the Celles Brewery exists now in what I guess would be its second Texas iteration?
Yeah, correct. Well, I mean, I think both of those in some ways go hand in hand, to be honest. He opened up technically in 92. It was just as another brewery, Hill Country Brewing Company, was opening up, but he technically opened up just prior. So he has the designation of being the first new brewery in Austin since 1878. Austin went through quite a bit of a drought of breweries, but home brewing, laws changing, people started getting the idea of opening up a brewery. And when the laws changed in 93, that allowed a lot of changes. But 92, he opens up and people were just, it was literally quite the media sensation. There's the one newspaper up in Austin, the American Statesman, has literally plethora of articles about everybody just geeking out on this Belgian guy out of the blue, you know, kind of like both of y'all were saying, why did he pick Austin, let alone the United States, geeking out about this Belgian opening up a brewery in Austin, Texas. And they were just excited. You know, it's like we finally get to have a brewery of our own, and it's this Belgian guy, because, you know, Belgians and Europeans, they know beer. And so the whole town went nuts. And what was nice is, you know, for not quite 10 years before that, there was a Belgian beer bar called Gambrinus on Congress Street in Austin that had opened up by a Belgian expatriate that had moved to Austin. And I had talked to him for the new book as well. But he had, you know, kind of laid the foundation of having Belgian beers more readily available in Austin and Texas in general. And then you had Mannequin Brussels bringing in some Belgian beers and so forth. And so a little bit of a seed planted there. But the fact that Pierre not just honored his Belgian roots and brought that to Texas, but the fact that he embraced Texas, he loved Texans because he said they talked slow enough that he could actually understand their English. And everybody was so friendly.
Oh, boy. Oh, exactly. Boy. That's just not nice. I love this guy. This guy is fantastic. Oh, that's horrible. He,
and then he's like, look, and there's a university here. And those university kids love to drink beer. So this is, I got to come to this town.
Yes. But so that's a thing. I've only been to Austin once, but it is a big university town, and it's a government town too, right? So you've got the potential for a great beer market if you can find the right beer for them, right?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, outside of everybody freaking out that even though a few may have seen his Hoegaarden wit when it came in, you know, 10 years before, outside of those freaking out as seeing the cloudiness or the haze you were talking about with the wit beer when Cellus White was coming out, and explaining to folks, that's not a bad thing here. There's a reason that that's there. There's a reason it works in this beer. When people tried it, they're going, wow, this is refreshing. And in Texas, we have, you know, summer 11 and a half months out of the year, with the exception of, you know, our
very your most recent inundation with cold weather.
No, sorry, exactly.
Why are you apologizing? Are you the one running the space laser? I don't understand.
No, but you know what it's like every winter where you find that one guy who's wearing jeans and a sweater and just got it wrong, and you feel bad for him. And then Texas.
Yep. Oh, no. Hey. I mean, I was raised in Colorado, so when this hit, it was kind of like the Colorado upbringing kicked in on how to handle it.
You went into survival mode. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It's like we're turning down the thermostat. We're putting on 5 layers of clothes. We're heating up the fireplace. We're doing whatever we got to do. But I had power and electricity and everything the whole time. I was one of those ridiculously lucky folks that whole week. But outside of that, it's hot as blazes in Texas to the point of annoyance the rest of the year. So a beer like Cellus White is going to be that quintessential get off a 110-mile bike ride and in the middle of Texas kind of beer that you want to have. And once people got over the cloudiness of it, they totally embraced it. And then you have that small amount of folks that loved the Hoegaarden Grand Cru, started embracing the Cellus Grand Cru. And Cellus Grand Cru actually, over the not quite 10 years Cellus 1.0 in Austin was open, Cellus Grand Cru was their largest selling beer.
All right, so we got to get to glass two.
We got to get to glass two.
Just so that we did it. But Hall, why don't you kick us off with glass two?
I don't know. We're talking about the 1990s and you know the beer scene and what people were finding exciting. And there's something about this beer that sort of speaks to that. I don't know. It's like it's a little nutty. It's got some generic red berry to it. I don't know, like a you know, it's got an ale type fruitiness, and I'm being vague on purpose only because there's not anything that is jumping out to me as super well defined. You know, it's just sort of like, I don't know, muted symbols, you know, being banged together kind of thing. It's not, no, but you know what I mean? Like there's some beers where you can pick out, you know, and I was texting with you.
I just pictured the creepy monkey. I just pictured the creepy monkey.
Yeah. But put like a paper towel between the symbols kind of thing. Just a little bit of tissue. That to me is sort of, and it's not a bad thing. Like this is a perfectly good background beer. And if I was at a, you know, a pub somewhere and this was on draft and I was in the right mood for it, or, you know, a decision beer, maybe, you know, you drink this while you figure out where you're going next. Like it's enjoyable. Like it's good, but it doesn't have any real fine points that I'm able to pick up on, you know, maybe that's me right now, but
I'm the other way on you here. Because the 90s thing doesn't ring to me, but I like what you're saying. My critique with it is it feels like, and this is me putting thoughts into Justin's head, but knowing how much I love Little Browns, I feel like he picked a Little Brown for us. And like you said, it's got a little bit of a fruity ale fermentation. It's got a neat kind of hazelnuttiness, malt bill feel. And what I think is interesting here is I think it's got a deft use of hops to shut that down. Right, because right where it's going somewhere, there's a little bit of like a centennial or a cascade hop being like, all right, you're done being malt now, drink again. But it's a little too alcohol warm for me, in as much as I feel like it would threaten me. Like if this was, it feels like it's a little too warm. If it felt less warm or is less warm, I feel like it'd be great for day drinking, like you were saying. But I feel like it's right in that place where as quick as I would need to drink this flavor, the alcohol is going to get me in trouble. You know, like I can't sip five of these in 2 hours. I can have three. And in this flavor profile, I want to drink five.
You're saying, Brad, this doesn't have, you know, some of that.
Think of Newberg's Brown.
But Newberg's Brown has a little bit more roast to it. And roast is not a word that I would use anyway to describe this. But Jeremy, what about you? Where are you feeling this right now? And what are you tasting?
Well, I'm definitely getting a very pretty character, almost kind of like a date or a plum out of this. And maybe the date's more because to me, my palate always picks up kind of a nutty character to dates. I'm kind of peg this as a pretty brown ale of some sort. I haven't had anything quite like this myself. This is definitely, well, I hate the word quaffable, but that is the first thing that actually comes to mind. I really hate the word quaffable.
I'm sorry. We have to let you go now.
$21.95. No, trust me. I'm beating myself up for having said that word.
That's what I was saying. It wants to be drink. It wants to be drunk, but I'm afraid it will make me drunk. And
see,
to quaff this, I need it to be four, and I feel like it's 6.5.
Yeah, I get a little bit of like alcohol, just a slight, the beginning bit of alcohol heat on this. But for me, there's something just about, there's like a cloyingness the more I drink of it. I don't know if I could have 2 pints of this.
See, I get the hops cleared out. So what if I said this to you, John? What if I said to you, all right, we're going to go homebrew, you know, John and Augie on the tippy. We're going to make Sam Smith's Nut Brown, and we're going to throw a whole ton of citrate.
Sure.
With those,
a whole ton of
that's citra. What I. Oh, I'm sorry, Cascade. You know, okay. I mean, just an American.
Wait a minute. Wait, yeah.
Just an American.
Just as Samuel hop. Intended.
But just an American grapefruit hop rather than a. Fuck.
Sure.
No, you know this what I mean? If I was has, like John, we're making Sam Smith's Nut Brown. With
like a West Coast,
a little bit of grapefruit West Coast weed to it.
Sure.
And the problem would be, well, we're done with it at 6%. I'd be like, fuck, John, we should have made this 3.5%.
Sure.
And then we could just drink this whole keg.
Yes.
All right. That's where I'm at.
That sounds like something that I would drink the whole keg of. This to me has, as I said, just a little bit too much of that cloyingness on the back end of it. And I don't know. And this is the beauty of the show, right? You two are digging it. I'm not against it, but I'm also not like,
John, say I'm not hating it. Say I'm not hating it. We're coming up on our sixth anniversary. Let's bring that classic back. I don't hate it.
Hey, Brian Cass, tell us what we're drinking.
Yeah, what are we drinking, Cass? Did he?
You guys are drinking Rogue Dead Guy Ale.
No.
Dead Guy.
No.
How is it? Oh, my God. I am completely embarrassed. I did not.
I'm not.
This beer.
You guys pretty much nailed it. This. First time we've had this on, too. I'm surprised after all these years. This is the first
it's a Maybach. They call this a Maybach.
Your Bach.
Yeah.
Whose Bach?
Yeah. Yours
their Bach. This Bach can be our Bach.
What is this star they got
with
here?
Pronouns.
That's what their flavors. That's the flavor star kind of.
But I can't read it. Star. I don't have my eyes on. What are the flavors?
Toffee, malt, and bitter. So you nailed that part when you said hazelnutty, I guess.
But what are those other two?
Roast and nutty. But see, no, we
the
also
the other two. What's the side that it doesn't touch?
Nutty and roast.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, I get a
although the nutty,
nutty but
it actually kind of looks like Huffy. The way that it's showing up here, it could be Huffy.
I don't have my cheaters, so
you know, if it's heavy, it's like whippets. Like this is fun. This is that would be a true rogue move. Look at this. This is a black matte can. This has got the old dead guy on it. This is it's a cool packaging.
Wait a second. Did one of you guys say? Did one of you guys bring up the beard beer at the top of this? That's funny.
We're bringing up Socks beer.
Socks beer, but somebody said Rogue in this, right? God damn.
Yeah, I referenced Rogue doing the beard.
There was a clue there. Had I sunk my teeth into that, I would have looked like a genius. Damn it. Damn it.
That was that was a weird fucking beer, by the way. That John Mayer,
I never had any.
I could not. I tried to do tasting notes on it for All About Beer, and I have to find it somewhere, but like it was a completely indescribable beer because it was so unlike anything else, except like, you know, if you had ever gotten really close to John, who I'm sure his socks would probably have some fairly fascinating new strains in it, but that's a whole other thing. Jeremy, I want to ask you though, just because you brought up this when the brewery had the fire and that he was sort of underinsured, and then there was the first closure of the brewery. And we could spend hours talking about Bobby Mason and Michigan Brewing Company, where he did stuff. And I mean, I interviewed Bobby back in the day, and that guy is insane.
And he's also not talking to literally anyone. I tried for months to get a hold of him or anyone related to him. And
well, he probably owes a lot of people a lot of money,
including his own family. Yes.
Okay. But then, you know, 2 years ago, the latest incarnation of the brewery had Chapter 11. And, you know,
wait,
I mean, the doors were shut.
Now we're back to the Cellus Brewery.
Yeah,
right?
we're back to the Cellus Brewery.
This Bobby guy has me all confused. I have no idea any of the words you've just said.
He's a footnote. I mean, Jeremy gives him like a paragraph in the book, which, like, the guy.
Well,
because
he wanted to sit down for a
study.
Talk. He wouldn't
I know it.
Talk.
I know. Now I know why. Now I know why.
I would be at least
21.95. You can read those paragraphs. Yeah,
exactly. I'd love to expand more, but really, buy the book.
We're running out of time here, guys. Yeah, and the book is right there for 21.95.
But there does seem to sort of be this like theme of success or perseverance despite some really like hard setbacks.
I'm glad you brought that up.
That was a layup for you, man. That was just like writers helping writers.
What's later on? You know, the problem is later on, you're going to tell me you're a journalist, and I'm going to reference that question.
No. Nope. Hold on. I got my follow-up journalism question.
You know, I love
this
it when
This is
journalists
me lulling Jeremy
journalists.
In with like a really nice question, and then I'm just going to knife him in the spleen as soon as this is over.
I'm fucked in about 5 minutes. No, you're exactly right. That's the one thing that I try to bring up a lot is, yes, it's almost like the story of the name Cellus, whether it's Pierre for the bulk of that, and now his daughter Christine and granddaughter, is almost like Lemony Snicket's a series of fortunate events. But at the same time, the name just never goes away.
Yeah,
it keeps coming back and coming back and coming back, and it just it just won't die. At least not yet. I mean, everything comes to an end at some point in time, but not Cellus, at least not yet, not today. And I would say to me, that is probably the biggest legacy is his passion, I think, is what drives this resilience. And that passion with, you know, you talk to enough people, a mixed bag of comments on his daughter, in almost no mixed bag of comments on him. Everybody loved him, but everybody's a little different. So you hear different things about different people. But the one thing that I think you always see is that passion that Pierre had was infectious. And I think that was half the reason this whole story spread. I mean, Michael Jackson, here, Michael Matt Jackson, of course, not one glove Michael Jackson.
You're actually, safe.
Yeah, no, yeah, on this show, you don't have to.
Although every single thief has a very good Billie Jean impression, they very much know the difference.
You don't want to hear mine. but no, I mean, you're Michael Jackson. God, I did it again. Michael Jackson definitely a English beer guy. He suddenly discovers Belgium, and suddenly Michael Jackson's all about Belgian beer, right?
Yeah.
I'm looking at a copy of Great Beers of Belgium as we speak.
Exactly.
I got one on my
he discovers
my
Pierre Cellus, and he goes nuts. Sure. Him and Pierre Cellus were semi-inseparable. So one other beer god we respect, Michael Jackson, not a brewer himself necessarily, but Garrett put Michael Jackson in that same pantheon of beer gods with
Pierre. Of course he did. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Of course. Absolutely embraced Pierre, and I think was a partial reason to Pierre just especially going everywhere across the planet. And Michael Jackson even came to Texas several times to see Pierre. I've got a photo of Michael Jackson coming to an equipment manufacturer in Texas, and Pierre shows up, Michael Jackson's there, and it was a semi-who's who of brewing in Austin at that time, and half of those people are still brewing in Austin now. So I couldn't get the photo into the book because of the quality of it. But it was
I'm picturing Jeff Stuffings in one of those baby carriers on somebody's chest.
Yeah, no. He is
with
he
the
is
onesie
not,
that says like Mama's there, little stinker on it. Yeah,
but, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mama's a
little better. No, that would be. I think Jeff was about 5 when this photo came out.
sounds about
but,
right.
But yeah, but I mean, half of everybody who's a who's who even now that's part of that old guard in Austin now was in this photo. So it was, if I could have gotten that in that book, it would have been a nice bridge between the Belgian story and the Austin and Texas part of the story because of the people who were in that photo. But
now the price of the book has dropped down to $15.21.
Well, I was going to say all the thieves need to go buy the book so he could afford to track that picture down.
Yeah. Yeah, to get a better printer to
Volume 2.
But here's my question though. So after the chapter 11 came through, and they got through it, they found new buyers. But you write in here that Christine, so Pierre's daughter, had to give up intellectual property of her family name and divest herself of ownership stake in the brewery. So who owns the brewery now?
So it's a
gotcha.
Gentleman who is a
spleen.
That I
take
way
it
to
all
Boston.
Back, John. You really dig it deep here.
Ouch. So oddly enough, that's
the price of the book is now back up to $21. Yeah.
Well, no, actually, now it's $21.95. But
John, focus.
So she actually does have a little bit of ownership in there. So I didn't find out.
Wait, page 113 says.
I know. She does have a little bit of ownership in there, but she did have to give up intellectual property and essentially any ownership that she had in the brewery. That was kind of part of the deal with the Chapter 11 and the courts. And the new ownership is primarily a gentleman who has, and he wanted to rename nameless. So I'll keep him nameless. I did in the book and I will on this, but owns a big construction guy in Austin, and there's one or two this time, other investors with him.
Sure. And then she's yeah, we're from Jersey. We understand what construction means.
Yeah, yeah. Come on. Well, does he dabble in carting?
This is not a cement.
It's called waste management. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'm Italian. I know all about the waste management.
All the codes.
I know every
all code. The wink nods. Yeah.
All the codes.
Exactly. No, this definitely was not that. But so they own it now, basically.
But it's a guy with deep pockets who.
Oh yeah.
Just wanted to be altruistic, or.
I think diverse his portfolio.
John, I want to explain to you.
Diverse the portfolio.
Allow me to explain something. You're going to get me in so much trouble.
Allow me to explain something to you here, John. Once you've got construction and carting, liquor and ladies is next. So this is just a program. I don't know if you watch any of the 70s movies I like by Mr. Scorsese, but that's a natural progression for business.
Oh, you mean Marty? Yeah.
That's awesome. And protection for hire.
That's right. Well, that's John, because of his gotcha journalism, now needs that.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. I hate to do this to you boys. Right when John was pulling up his reporter lederhosen, but we are 40 minutes in. Anyway, it's a real pleasure to have you. Thanks for telling another person's story. We'll get you on soon to tell your story because really that's what we like to talk about. But having information on Celis besides, hey, his brewery burned down and he opened in Texas is nice to go a little deeper because very often people are a little too thin on who he is, which might mean somebody should write a book, right? So there we go. Look at me, selling a book.
Jeremy Bannis is the author of Celis Beer, Born in Belgium, Brewed in Texas. It's available through American Palette, which is part of History Press, for $21.99. MSRP printed in the United States of America.
The minute you buy it, dog year, page 113. So you can gotcha Jeremy when you see him as well. If you don't want to miss your gotcha moment,
bring it to your next beer festival and I'll sign page 113 for you.
You can pretend you're a big boy former New York Times writer like my partner in crime, John Hall. Hey,
there's no pretending, by the way. It's
Cass,
just who I am.
Cass, if they want
to
make
it, I want John to sign my copy.
Cass, if they want to make it so that you and Justin can afford this book, how do they give us money?
Yes, thank you to those Patreons that do give us money so we can buy things. Patreon.com/stealthisbeer. You know, those dollars go a long way, so thank you for that. If you'd like to write us about mob corruption and whip beer, stealthisbeerpodcast@gmail.com.
You can direct that directly to Jeremy. Yeah, we'll give you Jeremy's home address. That's fine. If you have questions about that, that's not coming here to Jersey. That's going straight down to Texas.
Follow us on all social media at Steal This Beer and see what we're drinking on Untappd. Thank you, y'all.
All right. Thanks. Yeah.
Good as always.
Thank you. Jeremy, thanks for joining us. It was a real pleasure.
This was fun, pal.
Kennedy, this might have been your best episode of the year. Cass, thank you. Paul, I love you.
All right,
y'all, get at us, and we'll talk to you soon. Be well.